Thank you, Mr. Newton. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Newton is prepared to answer a few questions on the subject of his speech. If any of you would like to ask a question, would you please raise your hand?
I would like to have the speech of tonight and do a copy of his speech, please. Could I have it?
You won't be able to have it tonight, but we will make copies available. Of course.
Matt.
Gentleman at the back there.
Being non-political and non-sectarian, I realize that everything that Mr. Newton said about the way Hugh Quintless and his administration has ruled the country, but don't you think it's unfair to blame Hugh Quintless as our prime monster for all his problems when he very rarely makes a visit back to the country?
I would agree.
During that speech there, the speaker, Mr. McAfee, drew quite heavily on parallels with England for their socialist sort of decay in our economy. Would he be willing to go a bit further and give any predictions as to what he feels may happen to the English economy in the near future? And whether he feels it's relevant to Australia anymore?
I think that simply, the point simply is that the British standard of living is in a state of relative decline and has been for some time, relative to the other countries of Europe, particularly Germany and France and, of course, the United States. That's the first thing that has happened. Secondly, in Britain we can see the terrible lack of investment in modernisation of an already very run-down country. Thirdly, we see the the growth of hate as a as a force used more and more in normal affairs. I'm all right and you can get out of my bloody way attitude. And that attitude has been financed by profligate government financial policies. That attitude is leading to a situation like this. British Leyland went broke because they couldn't sell enough cars and they couldn't run their business efficiently, so we are told. But when they went broke, there was an 8-month waiting list for a mini miner. Now that is the sort of quintessence of the madness that has happened, and is the product of a long period of self-indulgence, of financial irresponsibility, of class hatred and the naked display of greed and the use of force. All that has combined to bring about a situation where in Britain all major industries will have to be nationalised. What ones that aren't nationalised, all major industries will have to be nationalised within the next few years, simply because their whole financial stability has been undermined and destroyed by this program, by this process. They've even got the situation there where Chrysler in England offered to give the workers a share in their business, and on the day that they made the offer, all their factories were shut down by strikes in pursuit of wages claims which were manifestly unreal. So I see the possibility of the growth of violence in England and in our country too. It is a time of violence. And I would not be surprised if in our country, if these tensions persist, I would not be surprised to see an assassination. I would not be surprised. The violence and hate is at that border.
Mr.
Chapman.
Mr. Newton, you made a few points during your talk. Some of your colloquialisms were a bit strong. And this is the first time I've been on one of your meetings tonight. In your opening remarks, you had what I consider racial, strongly racist overtones, in referring to Kanakas and Pakistanis. Now, being a member of the party itself, and I address this to both you and Mr. Chairman, are these overtones which you referred to, because you've likewise referred to the social hatreds being generated by the present government, part of the party platform? Now, that's just one question. Secondly, I want to know, since you ended up your talk tonight with a statement referring to your belief in the mass of the Australian community, which are strongly anti-communist, reflecting a disobedience, why can't this disobedience be reflected at the next election, bearing in mind that the structure of the Senate is, as it stands at the moment, can stop a lot of the legislation which you propose might come through, and I'm not disagreeing with you that it will be attempted. Furthermore, with regards to your comments on inflation and the Matthews report being brought out recently, what are your comments to the report in regard to income tax indexation? A few questions to talk about.
Yes, I am a racist. The Works Party is not a racist party. Yes, I am in favour of indexation of taxation. I am much more in favour of a reduction in taxation. I am very much in favour. I wouldn't be here tonight if I weren't. I am very much in favour of using all the force and all the energy that can be mobilised at any election booth in the country to stop what is happening to our country. But I have tried to give a sense of urgency. We're not talking about some academic debate about some fine point of democratic argument. We're talking about individuals who are using the democratic process to undermine the structure that they inherited. We're not talking about some mild interchange in a debate. We're talking about the use by the majority or by a government, which is not necessarily the majority of the people, it represents about half the voters in the country. The use by about the representatives of about half the voters in the country of power seized in a parliament, obtained in a parliamentary system, and using that power to undermine the very basis of the system that they inherited. Keynes is always talking about what's wrong with the system. What he means about what's wrong with the system is what he means is what's wrong with the structure of life in Australia. He's not talking about making minor changes. We're not talking about cosmetics. We're talking about carving people's features off. We're talking about cutting their heads off. We're not talking about any cosmetics here. We're talking about life and death. And naturally, I feel very intensely the danger that this represents to all of us. We're not in a situation where, sort of the Libs, have a fight with a country party or some piece of legislation going through that requires amendment of some kind. We're talking about the very seizure of power, the use of that power in a massive way. These people have increased government spending by 50% in the space of 2 years. This isn't evolution, this is a revolutionary situation. This is the revolutionary use of government money to change the whole of the face of a nation. That's what's happening. Talking about any cosmetics here, we're talking about very fundamental and very dangerous things that affect the whole of our future style of life. We're talking about the government using millions of dollars of our money in vast propaganda campaigns to persuade us how bloody well they're doing, to wash our brains with our money. So we're talking about. We're talking about fundamental changes in the ownership of assets, fundamental changes in economic power, in political power, in enduring change, the destruction of whole institutions here, the destruction of whole institutions, corporations, financial institutions, and the like. This is not some moderate debate in society thing. This is terribly urgent. And all that I have been trying to say is the socialist left have always used the instruments of demonstration, disruption, rabble-rousing, strike and illegal means to undermine authority. Now, don't let us think that we can sit aside and watch these people take our lives away from us. That's what they are doing. That's why I feel for them. Struggle occurring for the control of the means of propaganda in Australia. That is a very vital struggle that is taking place now. The Commonwealth Government is using its vast financial power to mobilise a campaign of propaganda. At least, thank you. That campaign has got many aspects. Not only are we being encouraged by all sorts of TV and press advertising to believe that what we are dealing with is a benign, all good, all wonderful government. Not only are we being asked to believe that lie, but the financial leverage of the government is also bound to increase in importance in relation to the media themselves. This applies particularly to newspapers at the moment, which are desperately short of ads. They have received a tremendous infusion of money from the Commonwealth Government over recent months, which is bound to have the effect of, to some extent, moderating editorial attitudes. there has been a situation where directly and indirectly this government and the Labor Party have conducted some sort of a campaign of terror against the people who hold TV licenses, particularly with relation to things like Australian content and the like. There is a campaign of terror occurring. All media in this country, apart from newspapers, are licensed by the government. This is an appalling legacy, in my view, that the Liberals left, where the means of expression are licensed by a government. In Canberra itself, an extraordinary apparatus of press relations, public relations, brainwashing, think tanks, etc., has been erected, involving hundreds of journalists, specifically for the purpose of undermining and countering every item of criticism of this government's actions. And I think that you will have to agree, I certainly believe, that if you look at the press each day in this country, at what we have got is a marshmallow press in relation to this government. So they have had a lot of success. Now, in the past, similarly, deals were done between, referring to your question at long last, deals were done between the Liberals and the owners of the media. No question about that? A friend of mine, Peter Kelly, who used to work for me, almost got me sacked at Fairfax by arranging a deal between Bob Askin and Warwick at the time when Bob Askin was going to be elected Premier. And I was sort of going to be the living sacrifice of that particular deal. But that sort of thing goes on all the time. There are deals of that kind all the time. Baldy was a past master of that in Melbourne. None of us is going to deny that use of political power, of money, of influence has occurred, and the many journalists have been mangled in the process. I've got a fair bit of scar tissue myself. But what we're talking about today is a different kettle of fish from some grubby deal between a premier and a newspaper proprietor about getting the premier elected. It doesn't really matter who gets elected in some of these constitutionalities. The parish pump affairs. But what we are talking about today is a major, massive propaganda operation of a style and size we've never seen before. It is of the same, it's of the same direction, but vastly greater in its pressure and its force than anything we've ever seen. And what we are being asked to believe is that this is a great and good government, and here's X million dollars a year of government money to wash your brains and prove to you how good it is. I don't know very much about what Mr. Tom Lewis has done in New South Wales. He seems to be a person who has something of a need to have his picture in the paper, and it's a fairly expensive way of getting it in the paper, I suppose. But as far as the situation in Canberra is concerned, so many of my colleagues, blokes who work for me, blokes who used to be honourable, independent political journalists, are working for this crowd. And they have, in my view, turned on their mates because they have gone over to work for a government and to help set up a propaganda operation of a size and a scale we have never conceived of in this country. And that is all being done with our money.
Thank you, Mr. Newton. Before introducing our last speaker this evening, I'd just like to add something to what Mr. Newton said to the questioner down the front here about the UK. I come from the UK, of course, as you can tell by my accent. I came here 10 years ago, believing that I was coming to a free country and escaping from a very socialist one. My wife and daughter are in the UK at the present time because I believe quite sincerely that it's the last opportunity they'll have to go to a free country. I certainly don't want them to go there if the troubles which I believe, Mr. Newton believes will occur, happen. Somebody else asked if the copies of Mr. Newton's speech will be made available, and certainly they will, on payment of the membership fee. I'd now like to introduce you to Mr. John Singleton, who is the person primarily responsible for the formation of the Workers' Party.
Thanks, Duncan. Maxwell. Now, this is now the 15th or 16th week that we've been having these public meetings, and tonight is probably the first time I've been able to sit at the back and listen to someone else go the full route, as Maxwell has done tonight. And it made me, I was thinking there, and he convinced me. I thought, geez, I ought to join this thing. You know, when I think most of us here tonight, there are two choices we can make, or three rather, as you sit there tonight. You can either agree with what Max has had to say and think, well, that's what I want anyway. I don't really want to stand on my own two feet and have a go myself. I don't care when my kid asks me in 10 years' time, what's the stock exchange? And you say, well, that's like the pyramids in Egypt. That's where people used to do business. I don't care that I can tell him that the government now controls his life as it controls mine, that I didn't have a go. If you don't care about it, well, you've got the right party in Parliament now. Stick with it and you'll get exactly what you want. If you are concerned by it, and you're a member of the Liberal Party, as most of us have been, or are, then you can let the Liberal Party know very forcibly that even though you belong to it, you don't care very much for their alternatives. You've read their platform, it's full of socialism, full of mixed economy claptrap. And let them know very violently how much you disagree. Or alternately, the third choice, the one I hope you will make, is to think that the greatest job that has to be done in Australia is one of education. I fail to believe that the great majority of Australians want socialism or communism, or you can call it whatever you like, a life that's not your own, that's controlled by 167 whacks in Canberra. I fail to believe that we would be better off with the first 167 names in the phone book. And if you agree with that, the only tool of education is if we get together and educate all people in all walks of life, teachers, students, and particularly politicians, that we're most unhappy with the whole thing. And what we want is less and less politics, less and less government, less and less taxation, and more freedom. And to be practical about it for a time, if you ask, how can public spending be cut? Let me give you a few classic examples. Let's go through the departments. Let's not accept the fact that 2 days out of every three that the average worker on $140 a week works, 2 days out of every three, his energy goes back to the government. If you were working in January 1971 and getting 10 grand a year, in January of last year, if you have the same real income, you need 21 grand a year. These are established facts. If you read Lenin or Marx, they will tell you that the quickest way to turn a free enterprise society into a communist society is to divorce or destroy the currency. Another gentleman wrote the same thing recently in a book called The Quiet Revolution by the name of Jim Cairns. Same fellow. He's doing just the quickest, quietest way to destroy the currency is inflation. That's an established fact of life. Inflation now is running conservatively in Australia 25% a year. Let's make it 20% and take a dollar out 20 years and it's worth 0.01%. 0.01%. In England, where it's now running at the rate of 46%. You can halve that, and that's not worth all that much. So when we ask at the end of the meeting to join, and it's $50, and you say that's a lot, just spread it out a bit. You see, we're not asking very much at all. You look at the other things and that's an established fact, the destruction of the currency. So you then think, well, then companies can find a way around that. They can keep increasing their prices every time that the unions, with their thug mob rule, increase the wages. So you have a referendum to control prices and wages, and when the people say no, you set up the PJT and do it anyway. So when you go along as a company to the government and you ask for a price increase, at their discretion they will say yes or no, you may or may not make a living. And if that's not, and that's an established fact of life. You look at the IAC, because when it's been impossible for you to make a living, you can turn to them for assistance. They may or may not give it to you. And when that's failed, you can then turn to the AIDC, who may or may not take you over. And that's nationalisation. And once the government owns your life and industry, if you'd like to define the difference between socialism and a communist state, then I wish George Bernard Shaw was here, because he'd fail to be able to tell the difference himself. You look at where our money's going. $2 in every three. 2 days in every three the average person works. You look at a government that's ripped off us $13.3 billion last year in tax and made a small mathematical miscalculation and overspent by $23.3 billion. When that, if you and I did that, we'd be having a discussion with Alexander Barton in Brazil about how people don't understand all this stuff too good. But if you run the government, you call it deficit spending and you keep a straight face and people swallow it. The government has now hawked around a $2 million account. It's now been talked about in the media as $500,000. The agencies were briefed at $2 million on a campaign to explain that inflation's good for you. Now, all these things are facts of life. When they get the $13.3 billion and they overspend $3.3, where does the money come from? They print it off those printing machines. And if you were interested enough to watch Norton Friedman when he was here, or meet him personally, or watch him on television, you would have seen graphs he brought out showing the consumer, showing rate of inflation in the last 10 years in the United States, Great Britain, Japan and Australia. And the first thing to rise on the graph was inflation, followed by prices, followed by wages, followed by prices. Inevitable graph, exactly the same in each country. Now what's the government doing with this money? Why should we work so hard and give it to Big Brother? What do we get back in return? You look at the department by department, the Department of Aboriginal Welfare. Their grant last year was only $161 million. The Aboriginals got $9,081,000. Where did the rest go? In administration. If that's not bad enough, in the last secretary's report, in the report, they said they could no longer hope to administer the department within that budget and were given more money and more staff. If the Aboriginals had got the money direct, they'd be the richest race in Australia. Look at the Department of Tourism and Recreation. Amazingly enough, the last public grant they gave was for the Stock Exchange building at Charters Towers, so maybe they see the tourist attraction of business in the future as well. And don't you think it's ludicrous? Don't you think it's ludicrous that Australia should try and compete with tourists? If you're living in New York, come and see historic Green Valley compared to Rome or Paris or London. It's just not on. The Department of Northern Development, anyone who's flying over the north can see that's a pretty cushy job because there is no development in the north. You look then at the Department of Minerals and Energy, and a classic example and one I'll repeat. It was in 1960 it was that the government lifted the export embargo on iron ore in Australia, because in their wisdom they knew there was only enough iron ore to last us for our own internal needs until 1965. And as it was running out, they said, we've got nothing to lose, let's open it up. And if anyone finds iron ore, good luck to them, because we know there's none. So Hancock got on the phone and said, listen, that was a good move you just made. I happen to have pegged out some claims, there's enough iron ore here to satisfy all the requirements of Australia and all mankind in every country in the world, as long as mankind can see into the future. And the same thing can be done now with oil. It can be done with 89 of the 91 commercially viable minerals, all available just in Western Australia. For the Department of Minerals and Energy, their job is to make sure that it stays in the ground. And thus, we only supply 7% of the world's iron needs, 42% of Japan's. And when you're forced enough to meet with Hancock, as I have, the top people from Japan and the United States, and you ask them why they don't buy more iron ore from us, they will say very simply that when you deal with any socialist or communist country, you've got to have five of each way, because you don't know which way the government's going to turn next. And we sit back and let that happen too. The Department of Housing, 13,800 people in a department that doesn't build houses. The Department of Urban and Regional Development, with a budget of $400 million a year, and this is a statistic that's easy to remember, they're set up primarily to give cheap land to the poor young marrieds living in Australia. The number of service blocks of land they put on the market in Australia in 2.5 years is none. And we can go through department by department by department, the Department of Defence. In Australia, if anything, we need internal defence, external defence and law courts. External defence in Australia is non-existent. if each of the 13 million of us in this Asian country, populated by so few lazy, apathetic Europeans, if all of us learned how to salute arms and present arms and all got in the one boat and didn't run into one another, the chance of defending Australia is zero. The only way. Audie Murphy died during Vietnam, and that's not coincidental. And if we like to think that some dictator in a country not only a few hours away likes to think we have hundreds of millions here and millions starving every year, a few hours flight away, we've got 13 million Europeans living in this Asian country and they've left all their wealth on the ground. There's an old axiom that if goods don't cross barriers, armies will. And it's inevitable that will happen in Australia. It's also inevitable that we won't be able to defend ourselves, and it's also inevitable that America and England aren't suddenly going to pick up the phone and say, hey, here's a great chance for some great World War III movies. Let's send a few troops over there on 20th Century Fox and let's get into it. The only way we can hope to be defended if we make ourselves make the most powerful nations in the world, including China, Russia, the United States, Great Britain, Japan, make them totally dependent upon us. And if people want to call us the quarry for the world, so what? We're talking about 0.3% of the Earth's surface of Australia, the richest country, pro rata, in the world, potentially. And once those countries were dependent upon us, totally dependent upon us for their own economic survival, then they'd have a vested interest in defending us. That is the only way we can ever be aptly defended. So what do we face in Australia? Wouldn't it be simple, any of us who've been through, had any dealings with those departments, to cut them down, not cut the rate of growth, cut them down, cut them out. Let's do those things for people they can't do better for themselves, and that is all. Let's make it illegal, as it is in West Germany, for a government to steal from us $13.3 billion, then overspend $3.3 billion. Let's show them the Companies Act and the Trade Practices Act, let them be equally liable. Let's get the AIDC and float it on the stock market and see what it's really worth. But let's most of all stop being con. We're sitting around and it's happening. It's an established fact of life. In 3 years, the economic fibre and the emotional fibre and the individual fibre of Australia has been robbed, stolen and strangled. And so few of us have cared enough to do anything. If we think we can sit back and let them go another 2 years and then the Liberal Party will come in and maybe do something about it, when, as Max pointed out, their history of any government undoing any previous legislation is zero, then we're living in a fool's paradise. The only hope Australia has to utilise its potential is for enough of us to care enough to do something. And it doesn't even really matter whether we win or lose. But it does matter whether we try. So your choice tonight is to walk out of here with a clear conscience saying, I want this to be a socialist, communist country. I don't care even now that my child doesn't belong to me, that his birth must be registered by government dictate. He'll be educated when the government tells me to send my son to school. The government will set the syllabus. The government will mark the syllabus. The government will tell me when he can leave school, when he can go to the government-owned university, and the government will set the exams again, tell me when he can go to work, how much he'll earn, how many hours a week he'll work. And that's in a free Australia. Picture it getting worse. So if you want it worse, you've got it. Just sit tight, hold on. You're home and home. Unless, step two, if you stay in the Liberal Party, you make sure those people know that we don't like their lack of policies. We don't give a stuff who's the next Prime Minister. What we do give a stuff about is whether Australia is free or not. And the only way you can really help to do that is by joining with us. In the 14 or 15 weeks we've been going, we've attracted members in their many hundreds, but it's not enough. We've got 11 branches in Sydney. It's not enough. Over 10,000 people have written to us wanting pamphlets and information. That's not enough. We've got Dr. Yule and Bob Howard working full-time with us with one secretary. They haven't been paid anything yet. That's not enough. As I hear daily. We do need help. There is no way that we can work a deal with BHP. Give us $500,000 and when we get in, we'll up the steel prices. The chances of us getting in next election are negligible. Zero. But the chances of us influencing people, of making people think, at least think,
then having thought, if they choose socialism, if they choose to be propped up to live in a totalitarian state, good luck to them. But if, having educated them to think, they choose a free Australia and a free life for themselves, we will have achieved something. We can't do it without your support. Anyone who walks out of here tonight with a clear conscience, because they want a socialist Australia, I understand, I accept that. Anyone who walks out of here and says, I wish you well, but it's not worth 50 bucks to me, I'd like to say I don't think Australia is worthy, or you're worthy of Australia. Thank you.